Hi, everybody. I am Ronnie Austin, and I am certainly an alcoholic. You know, this morning I'm not willing to believe that I'm not one. I'm the oldest of three children. I was the oldest grandchild on both sides of my family. And when I was little growing up, you know, everybody's patting me on the head and telling me how cute I was and how smart I was. And y'all can obviously see that they wasn't the smartest people in the world. But I had a great childhood. I was never mistreated. There ain't nothing in my life that I could say has happened to me has caused me to be an alcoholic. I'm the only alcoholic in my family. My mother had never had a drink in her life. My dad, only time he would ever take a drink was if somebody with business or something, you know, just a what you call a sociable drink. And I don't know what a sociable drink is, you know. But anyway, I grew up in the 50s and early 60s, and I think the best time, in my opinion, the best time this country's ever had, you know. You didn't lock your doors at night. You could leave your keys in the car all the time. You know, it was just great. But I never had everything I wanted. I've always had more than I needed, but I've never had everything I wanted. I've always had a problem with wanting more. Nothing is never enough for very long. You know, that's the story of my life. You know, we moved around a lot when I was small. You know, my dad worked construction with TVA, and we'd just go from one job to the next. And I was telling somebody over the weekend, you know, we moved from South Pittsburgh to Gallatin in 1953. And so I grew up in Gallatin. You know, I was originally from Sparta over in eastern Tennessee, but that's where I grew up. And went to school there, and when I first got in the program, I said I was an average student. And then after my mother passed away, she was one of them that kept everything. She never threw anything away. And when we was cleaning the house out, my wife and one of my daughter, my youngest daughter, I think, and her two kids was up there with us, you know, and they found my report cards in, from high school. And I flunked phys ed in high school. And my grandkids was playing basketball, and you know, both of them got scholarships. But anyway, they said, "Papa, how you fail phys ed?" And I said, "It's real easy. Just don't do what they tell you." You know, that's when I started drinking. You know, it was my freshman year in high school, and that was my first love affair. I'm telling you what, first time I drank, I didn't get sick and puke, and I didn't get in trouble, but I felt better than I'd ever felt. You know, I was always bashful, you know, and scared, and, you know, get me a few shots of Ignard oil, boy, and I'd perk right up, you know. I'd talk to anybody about anything. I've been there and done that, you know. Y'all know how that goes. My wife is with me here tonight, and or today, you know, and if she don't leave me in the next couple of months, we've been married 50 years, and I have to blame that on her. You know, if she'd have been like me, she'd have left me a long time ago, and I'm really grateful that she hadn't, because our marriage is just like everything else in my life. You know, since I've been sober, it's just continually gotten better. Like I said, in school, my dad wanted me to go to college, and I had no desire whatsoever to go to college. My brother and sister both went, and he would have sent me anywhere that he could have sent me. You know, that was before student loans. You know, he had to pay for all that. He paid for theirs, and he would have paid for mine. Matter of fact, my wife and we got married in Ringgold, Georgia, which, as y'all know, is not too far from here. And We didn't have a shotgun, but we was kind of rushed to get married. And all my life I've assumed that I know things that I don't really know. Somebody had told me, you know, that you could get married in Georgia if you wasn't 18, you know, and you didn't have to have anybody to sign for you. So we go down to Ringo, and of course, we get there and everything's done closed down. You know, it was seemed like they was hour ahead of us or something. Anyway, we missed her. When I picked her up, and I was going to Tennessee Tech, my little short, I had to show up for a little while, you know, to please my dad, but I majored in drinking beer in the parking lot and going to the pool hall and going swimming. I started in June, you know, but I didn't have no intention of going to school. You know, I was trying to please my dad. But we took off and got married, and I thought you had to be 18 to get a job, you know, in a factory or something like that. And so that's what I stayed in school for. You know, I stayed in school. I quit school on Friday the 13th. I was going to turn 18 on the 16th. So we headed to Nashville, and of course, it just broke my dad's heart, you know, when I told him I was going to quit school. He said, I'll give you the money, you know, I'll keep y'all going, you know, I'll pay you rent and I'll buy you groceries. And I said, no. Nope. And today I'm really grateful that I did that, you know, because if he'd started out keeping me up, he'd probably still be keeping me up. But, some of these kids now, you got to burn the house to get them out, you know. I knew what I was supposed to do, and I didn't always do it, but I knew what I was supposed to do. But my wife's sister's husband worked for Ford Motor Company, Ford Glass Plant in Nashville. And he had told me if I didn't want to go to school, he could get me a job. So we took off to Donaldson where they lived. And that was November. He couldn't get me on as quick as he thought, but he got me on in January of 1965. And I was just barely 18 years old. And then the only thing that kept me from going to Vietnam was she was pregnant. You know, if you wasn't in college or didn't have a kid or one on the way, you know, it was a direct, go direct to, you know. I missed that experience for that reason, but he got me a job, and you know, I'd always help my dad. You know, I used to help him wire houses and work on the farm, you know, and I always loved farming. I could never make enough to make a living at it, but I loved to do it. You know, it was kind of more like a hobby to me, but anyway, I went to work, and I was making it's less than $3 an hour, and that's more money than I'd ever seen. You know, when you haul hay for a dime a bale or something like that, it don't add up to very much. But I was making around $100 a week. And of course, Linda was, my oldest daughter was born about a month after I went to work down there. And of course, I didn't have any, my insurance hadn't took effect yet. And so I had to put the money up front, and it cost $250. Y'all can imagine how that's changed. And it's funny, I can remember a few things. I can remember things that happened 40 years ago better than I can remember what happened yesterday. I've got that part-timers or something, you know. Linda always said I had selective hearing, you know. Some things I can hear and other things kind of float away, you know. And I don't know if anybody else has that trouble. But you know, right out of the bat, I started having trouble laying out. You know, I worked afternoon shifts because that's where all the low seniority people went, was afternoons. You know, nobody don't want to work afternoons. You know, they either wanted to work days or midnights, and thank God, because I don't like midnights. But anyway, my drinking really kicked off in, you know, when I got away from my parents. Of course, I'd have left home if I hadn't been married, because drinking and what I was going to do wasn't going to work in my house. You know, I knew that. I wasn't too smart, but I knew that. But we got married, and of course, you know, Linda wasn't working. She never worked until the girls got in school. But, you know, all of our problems revolved around my drinking, all of them. You know, go out to get a pack of cigarettes and come back 2 or 3 days later. You know, and then want to know what's wrong with her, you know, because she's mad. Until I got sober, I wrecked about everything I had. Most of it wasn't too bad, but in 1967, some years stand out in my life, you know. I'd been laid off. I wasn't laid off at that time, come to think of it. I may have back up because of this memory deal, but I had a friend that he worked for Kroger's in Nashville. And he come by. I was working midnights at that time, and he come by the time I got home and wanted me to go ride in Nashville with him. And I said, I don't feel like it. I've been up all night. And he said, well, I got a case of beer. And I said, let's go. And, later on that afternoon sometime, we'd went to Nashville, and I don't know where all we went, and I remember there was a little old beer joint out there on Scottsville Road going out of Gallatin, and I was driving because I was an exceptionally good driver when I was young. You know, I just thought if NASCAR could see me, you know, that they'd bound to draft me, you know, because of how good I was. But I'd been driving his car all day. He had a new GTO convertible. And I pulled out of that beer joint, and I mean, man, I was going through the gears, and there was a hill up there. And I don't remember nothing. And I come to in the hospital. It was nearly a week later. And we had rolled that convertible. And had I had a seatbelt on, it would have killed me because the corner of the windshield drove right in the back of the seat where I was sitting. And they said that he was in the floorboard in the back, and my head was wedged in the frame of that convertible top in the back. I had cuts on both sides of my head and cut one side of my nose just about off. And I was messed up on the inside, you know. I had crushed liver and ruptured lung, is that right? Punctured lung and broken ribs and all this kind of stuff. And my wife, when they went to tell her that I'd had that wreck, she was walking out again, and she even had her dirty clothes that time. She was serious, you know. Had that not happened, she'd have been gone. She wouldn't have been back, because she'd left before but came back. So I'm grateful enough for that wreck, you know, because had it not have been, the situation would have been different. You know, I stayed in the hospital for about 5 weeks, I think, best I remember. And I don't think I ever really thought about dying, which they told me when they brought me in, I was dead. That, you know, they had to give me the shock treatment and all that. And Linda said they wouldn't let her back there. And when my dad got there, she said he just went in. And she said when he come out, he was just as white as cotton, you know. I was 20 years old, and just barely 20. But you know, that didn't happen because I had a drinking problem. That happened because I'd been up all night and all day. Drinking didn't have nothing to do with that. And Danny, the boy I was with, he done got him another car in a few days, you know, and he's still drinking today. So, you know, I found out when I got here, you know, what's my bottom might not hurt you at all, and what hurts you might not bother me at all. But we all got something. If we didn't, we wouldn't be here. But that started out for the next, 15 years of ups and downs, mostly downs. You know, in 68, they changed the way they made glass, and it cut out a bunch of jobs. And so I got laid off, and I was laid off for about 9 months. And the contract before that, they'd got a thing, they called it subpay, where they pay you 95% of your take-home pay minus something. And if you want to make a sorry person out of an alcoholic, you just start mailing him a check every week. You know, and of course, after that deal with the car wreck, you know, I was behind on everything I owed. And of course, what I do, I go out and buy me a motorcycle because I need something to do. And after that car wreck, when I got out of the hospital, I weighed 120 pounds, and I was trying to put weight on. I just kept eating and eating and eating and getting sicker and sicker. And they found out I had diabetes. And that was one of the first things they told me, you know, that you can't drink alcohol. And I found out they didn't know what they was talking about. You know, they weren't hardly as sharp as they thought they were, you know. I remember the first time I drank a beer after I got diabetes, you know, and I didn't know if I was going to pass out or go in convulsions or what was going to happen, but didn't nothing happen except I felt better. And I thought, well, man, these people don't know what they're talking about. I can drink. And those 2 years from 68 through 70, I was laid off a lot more than I worked. And I got into the motorcycle thing, you know, and I always got to look the part, you know. I'm like a chameleon, you know. Wherever I'm at, I'm going to do and act to fit in, you know. And, of course, I loved it anyway. You know, I've had the first one I ever had was a moped. You know, I probably ain't y'all old enough to remember what they were. It was a more or less a bicycle with a motor on it, you know. But anyway, I love motorcycles and I love cars. That's cars and... they was probably my first love, and then alcohol, and then Linda popped in there, you know. And you know, I never did have too much a problem with women, you know. Probably a lot in my head, but I didn't know what was really wrong with me till I got in AA. See, if it was somebody I really liked, I was scared to death to ask them out. You know, if it's somebody I didn't care nothing about, it didn't bother me. I didn't think one way or nothing about it, you know. But I really never dated but two girls, and the first one, the only reason I dated her is because I could get the car out. You know, my mother always wanted me to date somebody I went to church with, and I didn't. But if she'd give me the car, I'd show it, and I dated this girl, and I haven't seen her in a long, long time. If I ever see her, I owe her an amends because I sure didn't treat her right. But anyway, we started, I don't really know, we was 14 to 15, we started dating. I got a permit when I was 14 years old, so I've had a driver's license for, 53 years, except for one. You know, those years there in the late 60s was bad. You know, I just stayed drunk most of the time, you know. Most of the time I wasn't working, and when I was working, I wasn't real good at being there, you know. But anyway, in 1970, I had an uncle that had a little country store he was wanting to sell up in Sparta, and that's where my dad family's all at. And Linda was complaining about all these friends I got, you know. They'd always bring me home drunk. You know, and I'd fall out of the car, or sometimes she'd drag me out, you know, and just drag me out on the ground, leave me laying there, you know. And this one little deal, though, I forgot. When I was laid off, she went to work in Nashville, and I was supposed to be watching my oldest daughter, and I guess she was, I don't know, maybe three at that time, three or four or something. I don't really remember exactly what year that was, but last thing I remember that day, I was going to wash and wax my truck. And I had me some of that Russian stump water there. And, you know, that stuff would put my lights out, but my motor would keep running. Yeah. And when she come in that afternoon, I was in the house, passed out on the floor, and had the doors locked. My daughter's out in the yard. You know, and I don't know what happened. But anyway, we decided to move to Sparta, and I thought, you know, if I just get away from these guys, you know, and just, my dad had a farm there just right next to that store, and my mind, you know, that grandiose thinking. When I first got here, it said, all alcoholics got grandiose thinking. Boy, I got a double dose of it. But I thought, well, I just farm, run that little store, because I didn't think I was going to get called back to work to stay. And of course, it didn't take me long to figure out I don't want to be in that store all the time. You know, and all these people around there, is, you know, knew my dad when he was a kid, and it don't look good, you know, if you trading with somebody and they drunk. I mean, I was smart enough to know that. So as luck would have it, I got called back to work in Nashville. So I put my wife in running that store, and our youngest daughter was, what, 2 years old? Yeah, 2 years old. And, of course, I get find some guys from Cookeville that work down there, and they driving back, and we all get in a carpool, and everybody liked to drink. You know, my first night down there, I'm thinking, I always stopped at LaVert's down there in West Nashville every night when I got off from work. And all night long at work, I'm thinking, how can I get them guys to go by down there tonight and for them not think I'm a drunk? You know, I don't want them to think I'm a drunk, but I'm going to have something to drink. And so we get in the car, and by the time I'm fixing to say something, one of them says to me, so we always go by LaVert's down there every night. Says, how are you? Yeah, it's all right with me. Yeah, you just twist my arm a little bit and I'll be right there. And we stayed up there 3 years, and I stayed in jail up there more. I had a lot more trouble up there than I ever did in Gallatin. One of the best things was I had a 69 Mach 1 Mustang. And I was supposed to take my wife to Gallatin the next on Sunday to her parents, and this was Saturday night, and they went to bed, and I was going to watch a late movie, and I had me some more of that Russian stump water there, you know, and I got into that, and the next thing I knew, I woke up, and I was sitting right in the middle of the interstate, and it was just about daylight, and there ain't nothing coming either direction, and I'm trying to figure out where I was at. I just went under an overpass, and my car won't start, and I thought, well, I just passed out and run the battery down, I guess. I mean, and I pushed it out of the road, and I walked up there on top of the thing, and I was at the Crossville exit. And this guy was just opening this service station up, and I walked over there and told him that I'd run the battery down my car and wanted to know if he could pull it up there and charge the battery. And he said, yeah. And I said, is there any place up here this morning I can get something to drink? He said, no, nah, ain't nothing open. But he said, I think there's a few beers in that cooler there on the back of the wrecker. And they was. And so we went down there and hooked to my car, and I killed all of his beers. And of course, I'm feeling pretty good again by then, you know, and I'm sitting there running my mouth. And he said, that thing probably will be charged up now. Went out there, and it wouldn't do nothing. And he got to looking at it, and I threw the rod through both sides of the block. I just destroyed the engine. And my brother was going to UT, and I imagine I decided to go see him because I didn't know where he lived. If I could have made it to Knoxville, I wouldn't have known where to go, you know. But I called Linda to come get me, and she won't come get me. She said, you didn't have no trouble getting up there. I'm sure you can manage to get back. And I finally got one of my cousins to come get me, and of course I couldn't afford to put another engine in it like it had. And I bought a 352 out of a junkyard and stuck in it and traded it off, you know. And somebody was surprised. But anyway, you know, it was a DWI then. I got a DWI up there and lost my license, and you know, but I kept driving. I drove back. It was 92 miles from my house to where I worked in Nashville, and I drove. I never told the guys that I was riding with that I'd lost my license. I never told anybody I'd lost my license. we'd go to Gallatin, and I'd let Linda drive, you know, and my dad said, what's Linda driving? Because she never, you know, if we was in the car, I drove. And I said, oh, I just didn't feel good, and I'm sure he knew what was going on. You know, when I'm drinking, I can't tell the truth. You know, I got to lie. You know, there just ain't no other way. So life got pretty bad up there, and so I decided that my problem was I wrecked another car up there and totaled it out, and, you know, it was just the same old stuff over and over. So I moved back to Gallatin because my problem is I got too much time on the road. You know, it was an hour and a half if I went straight to work or straight home, which I never did. You know, at that time, there was some private clubs in Cookeville, and we belonged to all of them. You know, and they'd never close, you know. The law couldn't come in there. But anyway, we moved back to Gallatin, and needless to say, nothing changed. Now, it didn't take me so long to drive home, so I just ride around at night when I got off by myself and drank. If I was drinking today, I guarantee you I'd be on the road somewhere. Always was. But anyway, this stuff just kept going on, kept getting worse. And she went to talk to my doctor one time about my drinking, and my diabetes doctor. And I was about ready to run her off for that. And, you know, he told her that he wanted to see me, and I went down there. And I said, Doc, I said, if a man wants to have a drink every once in a while, he can, can't he? He said, well, yeah. He said, if you want to have a shot before supper, said, just leave off one carbohydrate. And he said, but there's not as much sugar in whiskey as it is beer. And so she, when I got home, of course, when I got through, the time I got through lying to him, he agreed to me that I had a wife problem instead of a drinking problem, you know. But anyway, she said, what'd he say? And I said, he said, drink whiskey, not beer. And, but that didn't last long because I chug a lug of whiskey just like I chug a lug of beer, and then I get in a blackout. And like I said, you know, my lights would go out and my motor would keep running. And I always ended up somewhere I didn't have no business being, doing something I didn't have no business doing. And so I guess it was, can't remember exactly, it was a couple of years, I think, before I finally quit sober. But one of my best friends at work, he went through Cumberland Heights. And, of course, my doctor in the late 60s there told me about Cumberland Heights. It cost $500. And if I'd have had $500, I wouldn't have give it because I didn't have no drinking problem. But anyway, after seeing this friend of mine, I kept playing. You know, I knew, but this time I knew I had a problem, but I didn't want to face up to it, you know. And, you know, if it happened to be this time of year, you know, I can't do nothing now. We got to get this planting in. Or if it's later on, I can't do nothing this fall, you know, got to get this crop in. There's always next spring or next fall or next winter, you know, somewhere way down the road I might do something. But right now, I can't do it. And but anyway, and he talked to me. He said, don't you think you're drinking too much? Well, yeah, I'm drinking too much. He said, well, you think you ought to quit? And I said, well, I don't know, probably. But not right now. And you know, he never did get an AA. He never could accept that he was an alcoholic, but he helped me get sober. You know, I think for an alcoholic, it's the last couple of years, or maybe three. I know the last couple of years, it really puts a nail in the coffin. You know, up till then, if Linda just stay off my butt, you know, if he's at work would leave me alone, you know, I'd be all right. And, you know, she tried for a long time to get me to quit drinking. And when she finally just quit, you know, she learned a little bit about Al-Anon before she got Al-Anon. You know, she quit trying to fix me. You know, the girls got big enough that they went and did their thing. And and then I'm thinking, well, hell, she's running around on me now. She don't care nothing about me. You know? So you can't please an alcoholic. I don't care what you do. You know, there's no such thing as pleasing an alcoholic, you know. And I've bought things all my life to make me happy. And it might for a month or two. You know, I don't know how many motorcycles and cars and stuff I bought. And then before I know it, somebody's got one that looks better than mine. It's got a bigger motor than mine. And, you know, now I'm paying on this piece of crap that ain't all that thing that I thought it was. You know, I personally think it was a grace of God. You know, my last drinking lasted through Christmas. And that year, you know, the overtime had quit. Matter of fact, that summer, I volunteered for a layoff, and I was laid off all summer long and stayed drunk all summer long. You know, go to a lake every day. A friend of mine had a boat, and we'd take the kids out there, and I'd get drunk, you know. But anyway, that year during Christmas, you know, we always went to my parents on Christmas Eve and my wife's family on Christmas Day. I can't go to my own parents' house without being drunk. Of course, I said I was half drunk. I mean, I never would admit to being drunk unless I passed out. You know, I was half drunk or two-thirds drunk. Now, I don't know what that is, but that's what I was all the time. You know, if I was moving, I wasn't drunk. I'm thinking, man, you're crazy. You know, you can't even go to your own parents' house without being drunk. And I was just so miserable, and I was wanting to get Linda and the girls home and get off of myself and drink. And I knew I was crazy. And this lasted for all that week, and I come in on the 30th and asked her to call Cumberland Heights. Now, if I'd had to do it, I'd have probably died. See, I had too much pride. And she called, and I couldn't get in for some reason, and I left again. And the next day when I come to again, I asked her to call again. And, you know, I think I forgot to tell you my sobriety date before I started all this crap, but I'm fixing to tell you. They said I could come in, they could come in for whatever the deal was. Well, they said if he wasn't drinking. She said, well, I don't know how sober he is. He just got up. And it was on up, seemed to me like it's probably 10, 11 o'clock or something. And I wasn't an early riser. but anyway, I made her send the girls off town. I didn't want them to see me going to no drunk farm. And I've been drunk all their life, but I don't want them to see me going to no drunk farm. But anyway, I went down there, and it was New Year's Eve. I went in Cumberland Heights on New Year's Eve of 1980. And there's this lady come in, Susan B. out of Nashville. Good-looking woman. And said she was an alcoholic. And I said, man, you know, the drunks I'd been around didn't look like that, you know. And she said, we're having a party over here tonight. You going to come? And I said, well, you ain't got nothing to drink over, have you? She said, no, and I said, well, I ain't going to no damn party. They ain't got something to drink, I'll tell you that. So I sat back there and detoxed with a couple other guys about like myself, and all of us just miserable. And but I made up my mind to learn everything I could about this thing called alcoholism because I did not want to drink, and I was scared to death that I would because it had been years since I'd been a day without drinking. I usually got drunk twice a day. I'd get drunk going to work in the afternoon, and then I'd get drunk coming home every day, you know, because we worked 7 days a week, biggest part of the time that I was in there, you know. And but anyway, when I got out driving home, I'm thinking, what am I going to do to have any fun? You know, after being there a month now, I can't go to ball game. I can't go to lake. I got thinking, and I found out I can go to all those places. I can go anywhere I want to go. About the only place I'd go with them to eat was a Pizza Hut where I'd get a pitcher of beer. And, you know, I'd got to the point where I didn't hang around with too many people because I didn't want you drinking what I had. But the only people I did run around with was people that drank like I did. You know, normal folks, I didn't want to be around them. And I still fit in better with sober alcoholics than I do normal folks, you know. Other people just do not think like I do. They do not feel the same way about things as I do. You know, that's what some people don't understand about alcoholics. You know, we don't, our feelings, you know, the big book says we wear our feelings on our sleeves. You know, things that hurt my feelings probably wouldn't bother most people at all. And then when I get my feelings hurt, I get mad. You know, I used to get my feelings hurt quite a bit, you know, come in 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning drunk and feeling frisky. And Linda don't feel so frisky, you know. Hurt my little feelings, you know. Well, boy, you just don't love me. But anyway, everything worked out just like it should. You know, I after I got sober, I was still working afternoons, and I was able to get a job that I'd been trying to get for 4 or 5 years and never had enough seniority to get it. And right before I got laid off, they posted one of those jobs, and I started not to go sign it. And I thought, well, it won't take 15 minutes to sign it. And I went up there and signed it and got the job, and there was guys on the other shifts that had more seniority than me. I said, well, why didn't you sign that? And he said, well, I was afraid I couldn't hold days. And others said, I was afraid I couldn't hold midnights. So I got that job. And then I got in December 81, I got laid off, and I was laid off for 20 months. And had I been drinking during that period, I'd have sat on a bar stool somewhere and lost everything I had, because I'd have had too much pride to go to work for $6 an hour. But since I was sober, I swallowed my pride, and when the money ran out, I went to work. But I got to go to a meeting every night. And, my youngest daughter wouldn't go to bed till and she's one I never had to tell her it was bedtime, you know. But she'd sit up till I'd come in, and she'd look me over. And she'd never say anything, but she'd smoke me over, you know. And then she'd get up and go to bed, and it got to hurting my little feelings, you know. And I told Wiz, I said, she don't trust me. He laughed. He said, she got any reason to trust you? Well, no. He said, if you stay sober, she'll get to trust you again. I said, well, I was gone all the time drunk. Now I'm gone all the time going to meetings. He said, yeah, but said, now, if they need you, you can be there. Said, you need to go to meetings and learn how to stay sober, but if something comes up that they really need you, you can be there. And if you're drinking, you ain't going to be there whether they need you or not. And I said, yeah. And he explained to me about the guilt. You know, he said, guilt is just pride. It's just running in reverse, you know, and I could see that. See, I knew absolutely nothing about me when I got here, nothing. I'd lied to myself so long. I'd always prided myself on working and taking care of my family. Of course, taking care of them was doing what I thought was right. You know, you got a house to live in, a car to drive, you know, what else you want? You know, my kids, my girls, I have 2 daughters, and I'd buy them, motorcycles, you know, because that's what I wanted to get them. You know, I never asked them if that's what they wanted. You know, that's just what I'm going to get you, you know. But, I have a good relationship with my children today. They love me. They certainly haven't forgot anything. But they love me, and I have grandchildren today that have never seen me drink. I have 2 great-grandchildren that never seen me drink. We have a women's house in Scottsville, and, I try to help some of those, I started to say girls, but they ain't girls. If you're under 60, you're a girl to me, so, you know, I've just always been that way. You know, if you're younger than me, you're a girl or a boy, you know, it's probably because I never did grow up. But anyway, I try to take some of them to meetings and try to help them. You know, I would want somebody, if my daughters or my granddaughter or my great-granddaughters come here, I would hope that somebody would try to be a friend and help them for just a bit, just to help them, you know. And I know everybody's not that way, but I certainly try to be that way. And, I feel like now that I've got some adopted daughters around, you know, because I love them to death. And and I think that's another blessing. You know, my wife, if one of them calls, she don't start questioning about who that was. Her mother lived with us for 7 years. No, it wasn't 7 years. 4 years? Yeah. And Sometimes she'd be sitting there and one of them call, you know, and boy, she'd just light up like a Christmas tree. What are you doing talking to a girl, a woman, you know? And I said, well, that's a friend of mine. And, you know, I'd kind of nag her on a little bit, and boy, she just, she'd light up like a candle, you know. And but that's another thing. See, she got in pretty bad shape, and Linda wanted to bring her to live with us. And had I been drinking, that wouldn't have happened. What, of course, I never had any problems with her, you know. Something else I never could understand, you know, I'm the only alcoholic in her side of the family. Some of the rest of them drank a little, but not nothing like I did. But she always loved me. Her other brother-in-law, she didn't care much about him. He's the one that got me the job, you know. She had dementia pretty bad, and one night she come in there. Me and Linda don't watch the same things on TV. She was in one end of the house, and I'm in the other. Miss Castile come in there, you know, and she had a pair of slacks on, and she had her bra on, and she had a pair of panties that she's trying to put on over them pants. And she was leaving. And now it's, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock at night. She's going to go down to her other daughter's, you know. And, of course, she wasn't paying no attention to nothing Linda was saying. She was mad, and I said, Miss Castile, I said, which way are you going to go when you get out there? Because we live out in the country, you know, and it's dark at night. And she looked kind of funny, you know. And I said, where are you going? She said, I'm going down to Sue's. And I said, well, you know, you don't care a lot about George, do you? I said, I don't believe you'll like it down there no better than you like it here. And, you know, I talked to her a few minutes and calmed her down. And her mother and my mother, my dad said, couldn't nobody, because I always kidded both of them, you know. And my dad always told me, said, anybody else talk to her like you do and she'd kill you. My brother and sister called me old blue eyes. You know, mama's always talking that little blue-eyed baby, you know, when I was the oldest. And they'd say, old blue eyes can't do nothing wrong in mama's eyes. And she'd have probably loved me to death, but, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I've sat here and talked all day about a bunch of other crap, but, you know, what's helped me in my life is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the traditions, and the people. You know, it wouldn't be AA if it wasn't for you people. You know, I tell them at meeting, you know, I might come up here next week, and if ain't nobody here, I might come back one more time. And if ain't nobody here, I won't be back no more. You know, that's the way I am. And I found out a lot of my problems by listening to you. Because when you tell me your problem, then I can see it in me where I can't see it otherwise. You know, that's always been one of my hardest problems, is to honestly see me. Because I tell myself stuff that I want to believe. You know, I want to be smart, and I want to be good looking, and I want to be all this stuff that I'm not. you know, my life is, I've had living problems. Everybody, you know, if you ain't been around here very long, getting sober is not going to do away with your living problems. You know, I tell some of these people that I sponsor, you know, it'll get better, but it ain't going to happen next Tuesday morning at 7 o'clock. You know, it takes a lot of work and a lot of time. You know, it took Linda and I some time to get our relationship better. You know, after I got sober, you know, I wasn't saying nothing much when I was drinking because I always felt guilty about what I was doing and being gone, you know. And then when I get sober, you know, I don't like the way you know, some decisions you're making about the kids. I don't agree with that. Well, just get over it, you know. So we butted heads there for a while, and but it's just like the program, you know, it's just progressively got better and better, and you know, she's not only my wife, she's my best friend, and I'd have probably died a long time ago. You know, she's giving me insulin shots when I'd be passed out on the floor, you know, worried about my health, and, you know, she's put up a lot of crap for me, and you know, our daughters, I think they tried to pick somebody like Daddy. That's the biggest problem we've had both our girls is, you know, their choice of husbands. You know, they ain't been too good at that. Had I been drinking through some of that, somebody would be dead. You know, it might be me or it might be somebody else, but somebody wouldn't have made it through that. And, you know, only by the grace of God that everything worked out and I didn't do something stupid. You know, there's a lot of mistakes you can make that you can correct. And there's a lot of them that you can't correct. You know, that's just like my mouth. You know, water and fire both can either save your life or take your life. And your mouth is the same thing. You know, it says in that other big book, you know, power of life and death in the tongue. You know, give you a little example of that. You know, when my parents passed away, my wife helped me clean up. You know, we had to do most of the cleaning up and going through all that stuff, you know, and she did and never said a word, you know, just. And her mother, you know, when she come to stay with us, you know, had to put some stuff that she had in storage. Of course, I didn't think that was a good idea either. I said, well, she ain't never going to be able to just get rid of it. Well, she don't want to get rid of it. I said, well, she ain't going to know nothing about it, no way. But anyway, after she passed away, you know, and we was going to have to clean that storage thing out. Oh, man, I didn't want to do that. And I said, well, rest of your family ought to help some on this, you know. Well, they can't do it. So we go down there to start cleaning that out, and I'm running my mouth, you know, just complaining. And she gets to crying. You know, and then I felt just about that tall, you know, because then I realized what I'd been doing. You know, and I can say I'm sorry, but it don't do no good. You know, I've done hurt you. I can't take that back. You know, I was good at saying I'm sorry. Most people knew I was. The deal is not to say I'm sorry, you know. It's try to make it better. But see, like I said, when I realized that, I shut my mouth. We went on and done it. But I done hurt her. See, and I can't take that back. My kids, you know, I love them to death, but sometimes, of course, they're just kids. You know, I think how my parents thought about me, you know, what I did. And neither one of mine has ever been as bad as I was, not nowhere close. You know, my dad, I think my 4 years in high school turned him white-headed, and he was in his 30s. You know, but, you know, today I have a wonderful life. I'll go through this right quick, try to, let's see, it was in January 09. Our grandson got married out in Missouri. He's in the Air Force. And we went out there to the wedding, and I felt bad out there. But, you know, they had the, what you call it, after the wedding and the country club and all these young guys, and everybody's drinking. And everybody's having a big time, and I did not see anybody as drunk as I would have been had I been drinking. I didn't see anybody walking up somebody else's wife and grabbing her on the butt. You know, I didn't see all the things that I would be doing had I been drunk. But anyway, I felt bad, but I thought it was just going out there, and got back home, and there right after Christmas, boy, I just about got down, you know. Well, I did get down. And went to the emergency room, and one Sunday night, I was hurting so bad and hadn't slept in a couple of days. And they done a CAT scan, didn't find nothing wrong. They gave me some antibiotics and sent me home. And my doctor was always off from Christmas till the 2nd. So I waited till he come back in the office, and I went to see him, and he pulled up and looked at that, and he said, well, I'm going to send you over to a respiratory specialist over at Lebanon. And he sent me over there, and when they checked me in the emergency room there at the hospital, I was just about to die, and I can never remember the name of that. It's a pain medicine. It don't make no difference. Anyway, this nurse asked me if I could take it. I said, I can take anything you got, and if you ain't got none, just shoot me. I said, I just can't stand no more of this. And, but anyway, that started a round of over a year and a half there. I was in and out of the hospital 8 or 9 different times. You know, I had double pneumonia, and I kept running a fever, and they couldn't find out what was causing it, and they kept running tests and changing medicine around. And this doctor I've got, Linda said he's like a bloodhound, you know. When he gets on something, he keeps on it. And he found out I had lupus. And they say it usually takes 6 or 7 years to diagnose that. And so they'd been changing the bed about 2 or 3 times a night where I just sweat so much with this fever. And he took me off all antibiotics and put me on prednisone. And I mean, by that evening, all that went away. You know, and of course, prednisone will give you this, you know. I was slim all my life, you know, and I always wanted to put some weight on, and now I'd like to get some of it off. So say you can't please an alcoholic, whatever it is, I want something different. But anyway, you know, there for close to a year, I couldn't get out of the house. I found out later I found out then that I had a heart problem, a leaky valve, and of course they thought they could treat it with medication. And later on in the, it was that fall before I went back in the hospital again with pneumonia, and I went back again with something else, and then that fall I got to where I couldn't breathe again. They said I got that COP, yeah, I've got that, and I've got a little case of, what's the other thing from smoking? Emphysema, I got all of that. And I got to where I couldn't breathe again. I think I was trying to cut hay or trying to do something. And I got to where I couldn't even get up the tractor, you know. So I went back to the doctor, and they done one of those arteriograms, and they just got an ambulance and shipped me right straight to Vanderbilt. And they did open heart surgery on me the next morning, and it went good, and a doctor told me, he said, you're doing exceptionally well. And I said, well, I couldn't do exceptionally well if you hadn't done exceptionally well. I said, all I'm doing is laying here and getting the results of what you did. I said, and he, before he done it, he said, 95% of the people don't have any problem at all. He said, 5% of the time we'll get a few infections. And I was one of the 5%, you know. By the time I got home, I got an infection. They had to go back in there and open me up again. And you know, and my wife, I had a stent. She had to give me antibiotics, a little old bottle of antibiotics every day for I don't know how long. And I couldn't lay down by myself. I couldn't get up by myself. She has done everything for me, you know, and now I've got used to it. You know, used to, we went anywhere I drove. I wouldn't ride with her. And now I've got to where she drives all the time. And I have learned after a time or two to keep my mouth shut. You know, I always want to tell her, get over in that lane, speed up, you know. And she's told me, if you want to drive, well, I'll just pull over and let you drive. And so I've learned to keep my mouth shut. Experience is the best teacher. But, you know, my home group is a Scottsville Step Study Meeting, and that's what we do. We study the steps. We go through the steps in the big book and the 12 and 12, and there's a few of them that's forgetful like me, so when we get through all of them, we turn right around and do it again. And we've been doing that for several years, and we have good luck with it, or for some anyway. But, you know, my whole life, for the most part, revolves around Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I sponsor people, and they sponsor people, and some of them sponsor people. You know, one of the ones I sponsor, and he's been sponsoring him, he would have had 5 years next month. Friday morning, he had a heart attack and died, you know, 53 years old. So, you know, the bell's going to ring for all of us one of these days. I used to always hope that I'd be right before I hit that tree or hit that car. You know, if I'd have a minute to get right with God. And I believe it'd really take more than a minute. You know, but today I don't have to worry about that today. You know, today I don't worry about dying. You know, my wife and family, they was worried about me through that surgery and all that stuff, and I wasn't worried a bit. You know, the peace of mind and the happiness, you know, that I've got since I've been here, you know, every day's not like that. You know what I said? But them kids, you know, as my granddaddy told me early on, he said, you know, kids, when they're little, they step on your toes, and when they get big, they step on your heart. And problems with kids don't start till they get about 18. You know, I wasn't a problem till I got up in there, you know. But it's the same for most everybody. You know, there may be a few people that don't have trouble, but most people do. And I don't know that it's really trouble. It's just something I don't like. I was in a meeting with a lady. We went to school together down at Galton several years ago. And we was talking about her kids because we went to school together and our kids was pretty close to the same age. And she said, I don't want mine to be alcoholic because I don't want to have to go through the pain. And I've thought about that a lot, you know. And back a few years ago, I think it was right after we moved to Scottsville, her son, he was one of us. And they had him in jail and had him, they say they got a chair over it, they strap you in. If you come in all wound up, and he died in that chair, you know, I don't know what happened to him. And he was in his, I don't know, early to mid 30s. I don't really remember at that time exactly how old he was. But so I haven't had to experience that, and I'm really grateful for it. But I do know that whatever comes down the pike, if I hang in here with you folks, and if I do what this program says to do, whatever it is, I can handle it. And if I don't have this program and you people, I can't handle nothing. Because I don't like reality. I don't like it today. I turn on the news and Linda says, well, why do you turn it on? You get mad. I said, I can't believe them idiots, you know. It's amazing everybody ain't as smart as me, ain't it? But I love you people. You know, this first time my wife's been with me on something like this, usually I got a carload of drunks when I go somewhere. And we have really enjoyed this. I really appreciate Milton asking me over here. You know, he asked me, it's been a little over a year ago when he asked me, and I said, well, if I don't die and I ain't in the hospital, I'll be more than glad to be there. And I've really enjoyed this. My wife's enjoyed it. Matter of fact, she won that TV last night. She was really excited last night. So I'm going to be going home with a happy woman, and that's good. Guy told me, said, you want to be right or you want to be happy? I like to be happy. Thank you.